You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. We are not available on some of our web streams today. So if you're trying to listen on the web, you can't hear me tell you this. I'm not sure what to do about that. We had a flood here in Washington, D.C. yesterday, and it took out our internet. So I have Twitter on my iPhone, and Louise does. And so that's, you know, if you want to feed back to us, I can't be in the chat room. We also can't take calls. Our calling system, our telephone call system, we have a couple of hardwired lines for guests, but all of our other call systems are VoIP. They're over the internet. And so we're not going to be able to take calls today. It's going to be an interesting day. But if you want to drop me a note, a quick note, as if you were in the chat room, our Twitter is Tom_Hartman. And it's a capital T and a capital H, although I don't know if Twitter recognizes capitals or not. I'm not all that. Oh, Jacob says it doesn't matter. So it's Tom_Hartman, you know, the underline. So our show is going to be a little unusual than normal with regard to those things. But other than that, I got a lot of stuff to talk about and a lot of people to talk to. There's some fascinating stuff going out there. Krista Rand is on the line with me right now. She's with 99andDC.org. And Krista, first of all, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Yesterday was not uncharacteristic. One of probably 3 or 4 days a week, I'll get a call from a conservative or I'll have a conservative on as a guest. I'm debating them. And the topic of college debt comes up and all this kind of stuff. And they go, well, I don't know why these kind of students are going to college, getting these degrees in philosophy and liberal arts. I mean, if they were just smart enough to get a damn job in engineering, they would have a job. I understand you're a college graduate.
Yes, and alas, I am one of those engineering students. I have a master's degree in civil and environmental engineering. I'm thinking about preparing our country for a changing world and for changing climate. In the meantime, the American Society of Civil Engineers has rated our infrastructure a D. That includes our transportation and our water infrastructure. And I don't know what makes a first world country if it's not transportation, infrastructure, and clean water.
Yeah.
So I'm here with this student loan debt, with this education, with this idea that I want to contribute to society using my degree, which is very practical and very technical, yet I can't find work right now.
And infrastructure traditionally has been something called the commons. It's something that we communally create. We, you know, thus things like the Commonwealth of Virginia, the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. You know, the founders understood this. They even named their states commonwealths because there was a commonwealth. And that commonwealth was the infrastructure. It was the roads, it was the bridges, it was the post office, it was the water supply, it was the septic systems. And so, you know, typically government has been at the forefront of providing those commons, that infrastructure. And I understand that you are exercising your First Amendment right to peaceably assemble and redress your government redress of grievances, to petition for redress of grievances. At John Boehner's office. Do I have that right?
Yes, that's true. You know, obviously I'm not in his district, but he's the Speaker of the House, and he sets the agenda. Right. Jobs and infrastructure need to be on his agenda.
And they're not.
And they're not. Yeah. They're not.
So, you know, for example, I believe yesterday it was, the House of Representatives, John Boehner, brought to the floor. So, you know, this had to go through committee and it had to go through markup and through discussion. And then it got to the floor. And it was this bill that says that if the president, as head of the executive branch, which has under its purview things like the EPA, decides to issue an executive order saying that some new chemical that they've discovered causes cancer is now being regulated, that the House and Senate have the ability to veto any regulations that come out of the White House. Now, not only is this constitutional, and not only is it stupid, but it's not going to pass the Senate, and it would never be signed by the president. And even if it was, the Supreme Court would knock it down. This is, you know, an exercise in a whole bunch of different metaphors come to mind.
Minutia, perhaps. Yes.
Yeah.
Well, and the fact of the matter is, our focus isn't really on the right things right now.
Yeah.
You just talked about this idea of the commons. Well, the commons aren't something to just sit back and enjoy. The commons are our economic engine. The commons are what keep us healthy as a country so we can focus on thinking about the future. The commons are an intergenerational investment. And if we let those things crumble without investing in them again, what is our future going to look like? We need to focus on the big picture. We need to focus on what our nation's priorities really are. Not partisan politics, not dragging feet, not trying to get reelected next term. We need to think about the future of this country. The time is now.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, Krista Rand, unemployed, master's degree in civil and environmental engineering, petitioning John Boehner as the representative of all of us, as the Speaker of the House, to put infrastructure on the list. More than 100 Occupy Patriots were arrested yesterday as part of the 99 movement outside of K Street. Are you concerned about getting arrested?
I am, but I am trying to be cautious and safe. I want to exercise my First Amendment rights, but I also would like to manage my risks.
Mm-hmm. And
spoken perhaps as an engineer might
sure.
might think about that situation.
There you go. There's that engineering. There's that engineering thinking that you've.
We
been...
call it a factor of safety. I'm trying to use the correct factor of safety.
A factor of safety. Oh yeah, that's
yes.
That's a good one. Okay, you're in your 20s. The
yes, I'm 27.
Okay, I'm curious. You know, I'm not. I'm considerably older than you are. I'm curious what your peers, engineering grads, science students generally, in my experience, or, you know, back in the day, back in the 60s and 70s and 80s, tended to either be apolitical or be conservative. And I'm not sure why. I think it just, you know, it worked out that way. It was the philosophy students and the literature students and the psychology students who were the liberals. And is there any politics? You know, what's the state in your mind of political awareness of college students today? And does it break out by discipline?
Well, I think for the most part, the generalization you just made holds fairly true. But let me tell you about myself. I'm unusual for a couple of reasons. One is for my progressive politics. The other is because I'm a woman in engineering. Actually, I'm a mother in engineering. Women and mothers in particular are not often in the engineering field for a variety of reasons. And you're correct that people with progressive politics aren't often either. However, if we are aware of the issues that are going on today in the country, it's crucial that we stand up and make sure that we are heard, because we're representatives for the 99%. And when we realize that and can articulate that and can bear witness to that, I think it makes a big difference. So perhaps I'm unusual compared to other people in my area, but it's an unusualness that I think is helpful in making this message about the 99% being heard.
Yeah, well, and that's an extraordinary and important thing. And I mean, you are the future, you and your child. You know, I mean, you're going to live long beyond many of the rest of us. And the old Iroquois notion of every decision made by government must be made in the context of seven generations down the road. I mean, if we could just be thinking one generation ahead, it would make sense.
Exactly. I don't want our ability to provide clean water to our families to be interrupted in my daughter's lifetime. I don't want our ability to travel to see family and to travel to keep interstate commerce flowing to fail in my daughter's lifetime.
Yeah, well said. Krista Rand, petitioning John Boehner's office, 99indc.org. Krista, thank you.
Thank you.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
This is great. This is the future of America. And the future of America is waking up and saying, no, we're not going to take this nonsense anymore.
We're the 99.
20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, live from Washington, D.C., where we had a flood last night, and it took out all of our Internet service. to our entire building, not just our building. Apparently, there's several blocks that are down. And, you know, the kind of bad news is that we lost our internet. The good news is the Heritage Foundation is right next door. I haven't asked them if they've lost their internet, but I do know that several blocks are down. So maybe they've got, I don't know, maybe they've got some kind of backup, and maybe we should be looking into one. But and apologies to our non-commercial stations who can't hear me apologize. We feed our Pacifica affiliates via the audio port. And if Louise will be tweeting that out soon. I wanted to thank Jack and Andrew Pang over on Twitter who have retweeted my message that I'm not able to get into our chat room today. I can't even get to our own website today because basically the only access I have to the internet is my iPhone. And I've got the Twitter app on my iPhone so I can read tweets from you and I will respond to them if there are things you want to talk about on the air. It's not quite like being a caller, right? But, you know, if there's something you want to say, our tweet is Tom_Hartman. And so there you go. And that's the deal. Something amazing. This my Occupy LA arrest, Patrick Meighan. I'm assuming it's pronounced Meighan. It's Meighan. And I saw this over at Democratic Underground. It's cross-posted from myoccupyla.blogspot.com and also from the Daily Kos. And this just captured me. He says, my name is Patrick Meighan. I'm a husband, a father, a writer at the Fox animated sitcom Family Guy, and a member of the Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Santa Monica. So who he is. And he was at Occupy LA when the police moved in. And he writes, it was horrible to watch and apparently designed to terrorize the rest of us. At least I was sufficiently terrorized. I unlinked my arms voluntarily and informed the LAPD officers that I would go peacefully and cooperatively. I stood as instructed, and then I had my arms wrenched behind my back, and an officer hyperextended my wrists into my inner arms. It was super violent. It hurt really bad, and he was doing it on purpose. When I involuntarily recoiled from the pain, the LAPD officer threw me face first to the pavement. He had my knees behind my back, so I landed right on my face. The officer dropped his knee on my back and ground my face into the pavement. It really, really hurt. And my face started bleeding, and I was very scared. I begged for mercy, and I promised that I was honestly not resisting and would not resist. My hands were then zip-cuffed very tightly behind my back, where they turned blue. I am now suffering nerve damage in my right thumb and palm. He then goes on to point out, and this is where it goes from, you know, one man's story of his experience with police brutality. And that is police brutality. That is an excessive use of force by the police department. It's not lethal force, but it's excessive force. And the police officer who arrested him should himself be arrested. This is an assault. But moving beyond that, he said, now let's talk about a man who was not arrested last Wednesday. Patrick was arrested last Wednesday. He says, let's talk now about a man who was not arrested last Wednesday. He is a former Citigroup CEO, Charles Prince. Under Charles Prince, Citigroup was guilty of massive coordinated securities fraud. For his 4 years in charge of massive repeated fraud at Citigroup, Charles Prince received $53 million in salary and also received another $94 million in stock holdings. What Charles Prince has not received is a pair of zip cuffs. The nerves in his thumb are fine. No cop has thrown Charles Prince onto the pavement face first. Each and every peaceful, nonviolent Occupy LA protester arrested last week has spent more time sleeping on a jail floor than every single Charles Prince on Wall Street combined. I can't say it better than the writer for Family Guy, Patrick Meighan said it, so I just want to totally give credit to him and say good on you, Patrick, for being there, for standing up, for being absolutely nonviolent, for trying to cooperate with the police when they confronted you. My apologies on behalf of the United States of America as a citizen of this country, where the laws are quite clear and the police policies are quite clear all across the nation, that police should use a level of force up to and necessary to protect themselves and do their jobs and nothing beyond that. My apologies to you that Los Angeles police officer hurt you unnecessarily. I think all of us as a nation need to apologize to Patrick, and we need to say to the Los Angeles City Council and the mayor and the chief of police, what the hell are you people doing? Or words to that effect. And then we need to get on with saying, and Charles Prince and the others at Citigroup and at Wells Fargo and at Bank of America and over on K Street yesterday, where over 100 American patriots got arrested in a driving, freezing rain. These people had the courage of their convictions to come out and say, we are sick and tired of our government being bought and paid for by giant corporations who are paying, in many cases, no taxes whatsoever. In fact, getting tax refunds, creating such a crisis in the states that the states are laying off people. Why? Because tax collections are half of what they were when Ronald Reagan was president at the state level. It's got nothing to do with union employees making too much money or any of that kind of nonsense.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
People are waking up. Have a question or comment? Tweet me at Tom_Hartman. Want to also apologize to Patrick? Let me know. We'll pass it along. I mean, this is what has happened. Our corporations have become the holy entities of our country, and they're wrong. I mean, it is wrong. It's not they're wrong. Corporations have a right to exist. They just don't have a right to run our government. They don't have a right to buy our politicians. The Supreme Court gave them that right. The Supreme Court was corrupt in doing that. The Supreme Court, well, you've heard my rant. It's just wrong. Sean tweets to Tom_Hartman, says, sorry, Patrick, you deserve better. The LAPD are, and then there's a hashtag there, and I'm not sure what it goes to, so I'll just let you check it out. And Benedict at Large tweets, Tom_Hartman, at Tom_Hartman, this sort of police brutality is standard procedure in poor neighborhoods across the U.S. for a long time. You are absolutely right. And this was a point that Dick Gregory made to me the other day on our TV show when he said, you know, African-Americans, particularly those of his age, Dick Gregory's in his 70s, who had been part of the civil rights movement. He said, we've been putting up with this stuff our entire lives. And he said, now, you know, a bunch of young white people who have the benefit of 400 years of white privilege and who never imagined such a thing could ever happen to them are discovering what's behind the mask. These are my words, not his. I'm paraphrasing essentially what he said. And it's true. And those of us, you know, back in the 60s and or late 60s, early 70s, who got tear gassed and pepper gassed and arrested in the streets protesting the Vietnam War, experienced very similar things. And, you know, getting put in jail and getting your head shaved and getting sprayed with DDT and you know, body cavity searches and all the other things that we were subjected to. And anyhow, so here, Hattie tweets at Tom_Hartman. Patrick get the officer's name and badge number? If so, Hattie, I don't know. I didn't see it in his post. Hattie says, let's use social media to spread the word and protect each other. And good idea. So thank you for those tweets. Bernie Sanders, yesterday we had on a member of Congress who Keith Ellison, the member of the House of Representatives from Minnesota, who has proposed a constitutional amendment in the House of Representatives to say corporations aren't persons. It's one of several. Today, Bernie Sanders put one into the House, into the United States Senate. And in fact, let me share it with you. It's really quite remarkable. It says, Section 1, the rights protected by the Constitution of the United States are the rights of natural persons and do not extend to for-profit corporations, limited liability companies, or other private entities established for business purposes or to promote business interests under the laws of any state, the United States, or any foreign state. Now, that's a great start. And, you know, what I would say to Bernie if he was sitting here or his staff or whoever could put this thing together is, why stop there? You know, I don't think that churches should be able to lobby or buy political ads, you know, or buy politicians. And frankly, I know that my union, you know, my friends in the union movement shudder when I say this, but I don't think unions should be able to either. Simply say no organization can do it. Any form of corporation, for-profit or non-profit, incorporated for the purpose of business, religion, union, whatever. Now, the reason why this would actually work to the benefit of the unions is because unions can mobilize their members. The reason why it won't horribly damage the church's ability to be politically active is because churches can mobilize their members. I mean, the civil rights movement came out, in large part came out of the churches. The Reverend Martin Luther King, remember? But it'll really take a whack out of corporations. So I would have done it, you know, right across the board. But nonetheless, he limits it to business corporations, which is fine. You know, I'll take anything I can get. Section 2, such corporate and other private entities established under law are subject to regulation by the people through the legislative process so long as such regulations are consistent with the powers of Congress and the states and do not limit the freedom of the press. Keep in mind, we're talking about amending the Constitution. This is not a law. This is a big deal. Section 3, such corporate and other private entities shall be prohibited from making contributions or expenditures in any election of any candidate for public office or the vote upon any ballot measure submitted to the people. Wow. I mean, that just literally right there strips corporate money out. This is a restatement of the law that was passed back in 1907 during the administration of Teddy Roosevelt that said that corporations that give money to politicians go to, you know, the politician goes to jail, the corporation, the CEO can go to jail, whoever made the decision can go to jail, the corporation can be dissolved. There's huge criminal penalties as well as large civil fines. Okay, now that, what those penalties and fines would be established by legislation that kind of follows on the tail of this. But here, I mean, they're just like being prohibited in this constitutional amendment. It's not just that they're giving Congress the power to prohibit it. It's that they are prohibited. Section 4, I mean, this is in that regard, Bernie's proposal is even stronger than what I would say. I would say give Congress the right to prohibit it. But, you know, that I have no disagreement with this. I'm just telling you, you know, these are stylistic things, I suppose, more than anything else. Section 4, Congress and the states shall have the power to regulate. See, this is what I would have said, and I think, you know, it's kind of redundant with Section 3. But nonetheless, Section 4, Congress and the states shall have the power to regulate and set limits on all election contributions and expenditures, including a candidate's own spending, and to authorize the establishment of political committees to receive, spend, and publicly disclose the sources of those contributions and expenditures. So you can do politics. You can participate in politics. You just have to do it in a transparent fashion. And Congress will establish the rules. And I realize that there are cynical people who are saying, well, if Congress is establishing the rules, then, you know, they're gonna set up the rules so that they can just do whatever they want, and, you know, we're toast, and they can take all the money they want. I don't think so. I genuinely don't think so. I think that there are a few people in Congress who are corrupted by money because they have so much of it. You know, Daryl Issa is probably a classic example. Here's a guy who's a small-time crook. In fact, I think he's probably the only criminal in the House of Representatives, the only guy who has a criminal past. But Daryl Issa, came up with this car alarm or bought out a company or something. You know, I don't know the whole story of it, but he had this car alarm business, and he made hundreds of millions of dollars. He manufactures them in China, as I recall. He manufactures them offshore someplace. And he's a guy, he's the example of the kind of guy who would say, oh, no. You know, let's keep a bought off Congress, because he can buy himself off. And he can buy off other members of Congress. Daryl Issa passes out money to other members of Congress, which is one of the ways he got to be the head of the House Investigations Committee, and he's, you know, looking into Solyndra and all these other scandals and Fast and Furious, and let's make the Obama administration look bad. Daryl Issa, in my opinion, one of the most corrupt members of the House of Representatives, and one of the richest. He's the richest, if not the second richest member of the House of Representatives, and so a multimillionaire, multi-hundred millionaire. So he would be, you know, one of the guys who would say, no, let's keep the money in politics. But I can tell you the majority of members of Congress, even those who are fairly well off, which is most of the Senate, it really chafes their behind that they have to leave their office on Capitol Hill and go to a private office that they rent, where they can pick up the phone and they can call donors around the country and beg for money. I mean, what a crummy job. Hey, what's your job? My job is to beg for money most of the time, as a member of Congress or as a member of the, you know, as a member of the House, a member of the Senate. I mean, the President of the United States has to do this. Beg for money. I mean, there's something wrong with that. There's something fundamentally wrong with it. So, like in the UK, I mean, what this constitutional amendment would allow, I believe, is that we could have a system sort of like the UK, where basically the parliament passes a law that says you can't spend more than 100,000 British pounds, 160,000 bucks, on an election. And nobody can spend it on your behalf. Period. Now, what's the upshot of that? The upshot of that is, number one, the media doesn't play the game that they play right now. When somebody's down, they lift them up. When they're up, they knock them down, so that it always looks like there's a big horse race, so that they'll get more eyeballs and sell more advertising, number one. Number two, they won't make a fortune on the advertising. But number three, most important, their politicians are spending their time doing the business of the people rather than raising money. And that's a pretty important thing. 45 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, Judge Carbon is joining us live from Radio Row in New York City. It's Time to Talk Day on Violence Against Women. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you 10 minutes before the hour, and we did get our internet back up. We are now streaming again. We're webcasting again. We're videoing again. We're all those cool things. And over at Twitter, because we've been using Twitter because I couldn't get in my chat room this morning, and, well, we're on Twitter every day anyway, but I usually don't have it up on my screen in front of me. Maybe I should start doing this. But I had the Twitter app on my iPhone. So some interesting questions. Speedbird points out we're now available. Cool. Thank you. Thank you for tweeting that out, Speedbird. And a number of people apologizing to Patrick on behalf of all of us for what the Los Angeles police did. I think that's good and that's appropriate. And Linda asks, I've always wanted to ask you and Louise, where in the world would you retire to live? You know, George Bernard Shaw said a bunch of very interesting things in his old age. I don't think I'm in my old age yet, but they were in, you know, thinking about, you know, in answering a question, what would you do when you retire? I remember these things. I remember him saying things like, you know, youth is wasted on the young. And if I'd known I was going to live this long, I would have taken better care of myself. But the one that I thought was most interesting, and that in many ways I've lived my life by, and that frankly I intend to live my life by, when you ask, you know, where in the world would I retire, is that George Bernard Shaw said, I want to be all used up when I die. And so I don't have any plans to retire. I'm just going to keep going until I fall over. And, you know, maybe 10 years from now, maybe 20 years, maybe 30 years, who knows? God willing. And just so long as Louise is with me, and if Higgins can stick around, I don't know how old he is now. He's well over 10. But I'll be in good shape. 866-987-THOM, our telephone number. Our phones are up now as well. Sanchez in East Los Angeles. Hey, Sanchez, what's up?
Senor Hartman, a very good morning to you as always.
Thank you.
I wanted to, if I could, make a comment. You were just mentioning Patrick's arrest at Occupy LA, and I was arrested as well at that very same event. And I've got like 1,000 stories that could relate to you on top of Patrick's incident on one of the other buses. Because, see, LAPD was overwhelmed. They were okay, they went through the motions in the staging area, but they weren't prepared for so many people to be arrested. So they didn't have an adequate amount of space at the main central jail downtown. So they had to put shuttle people up to Van Nuys, and they were kept on buses so long, they were prevented from going to the bathroom or taking any kind of a break. So one of the poor women who had to go really bad, the girls around her had to help her, and she actually had to go on the bathroom after requesting several times. I mean, human, you can
That's
only
amazing.
Hold it so
That's
long.
Amazing.
And in the cell blocks back at the Metro jail, once again, they were overwhelmed by so many people. The original count that they had for the people was a little over 200. But then when you added in the people that were arrested from the outlying areas, that was an additional 100 people.
Yeah.
That
were added Sanchez, to I got it. I'm sorry to cut you off. It's not that I have, you know, I would love to do the entire segment with you, but I have a guest who I should have brought on right at the very beginning of the segment. My apologies, Sanchez. Judge, and to the judge. Judge Susan Carbon is with us, the website is thatsnotcool.com, and is the director of the United States Department of Justice's Office on Violence Against Women. We are participating with the Talk Radio News Service, Talkers Magazine, in the Violence Against Women Day, the Speak Out Day in Radio Row. It's Time to Talk Day in New York City. And Judge Carbon, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. How are you today?
I am well. I hope I'm pronouncing your name right.
That's exactly right. Just
okay.
Carbon paper.
Great. Okay. You are the director of the United States Department of Justice's Office on Violence Against Women. What is the state in America of violence against women as compared to other developed countries, and what's the state of affairs with regard to what we're doing about it?
Well, the state of affairs is that since the passage of the Violence Against Women Act, the original act in 1994, we have reduced domestic violence, sexual violence, stalking, and dating violence significantly, and yet still, to this day, these crimes remain an incredible part of our social injustice, if you will,
mm-hmm.
and our current circumstances. We have far too many crimes that still are happening against women in this country, and that's reflected internationally as well. It's really important for those listening to understand that we are a part of the broader global community, and what happens here has an impact abroad. Likewise, what happens abroad has an impact here. And all of us are concerned about ending violence against women in all of its forms, both here and abroad.
At the same time, and I realize I assume that you're not political, you know, and not interested in going into politics, but the recent Herman Cain thing and all this other stuff brought out all these right-wing commentators basically saying, you know, that women who make charges of these kinds of things, this was, you know, well, actually one of them was a form of sexual violence, are just, you know, blowing it out of proportion, quack, quack, quack. To what extent in our society are we not anywhere close yet to having laws that protect women against violence?
We have some very good, solid laws to protect women against violence. Part of our problem is that we don't have enough services and we don't have enough funding to support programs throughout the country.
Uh-huh. And is it also an issue of people not taking it seriously?
That is very true, in particular around the area of sexual assault, because that is probably, in my view, one of our least reported or most underreported crimes in America. We have taken this issue very seriously, and as we look at the reauthorization of the Violence Against Women Act, which coincidentally was just introduced last week by Senator Leahy and Senator Crapo, is a bipartisan bill.
Mm-hmm.
We see a greater emphasis on trying to meet the needs of those survivors of sexual assault through a greater criminal justice response to this problem, because it is still a crime which people don't understand. They are embarrassed to talk about, and when we don't talk about rape, then it's very difficult to change the cultural landscape and change the criminal justice response, both of which are so critical to ending this crime.
Well, Judge Carbon, thank you so much for being with us. Thank you for the work that you're doing as the director of the U.S. Department of Justice's Office on Violence Against Women. And thatsnotcool.com, the website for, I believe, the It's Time to Talk Day. Do I have that right?
It could be part of one of the websites which they're focusing on, and it's a very important website. I encourage all your readers or all your listeners to look at it.
Okay, we'll do it. Thank you, Judge Carbon.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back to the second hour of our program. Tom Hartman here with you. And, oh man, in our first hour we were talking about what happened with the police in a simple arrest. Police officers, and I say this as a graduate of the Georgia Police Academy, police officers are trained that you use a level of force necessary and one step above, right? In other words, the force directed at you, you go one step above. The level of force necessary to stop force being directed towards you or to restrain somebody to prevent them from harming themselves or continuing to commit a crime or whatever, and not beyond that. And, we will get back to that, but I think that there's this, and we had Jesse Ventura on a couple days ago, and he sued the TSA because he said, he was going through an airport, and here he is, he's a Navy SEAL, he's the former governor of the state of Minnesota, a U.S. citizen his entire life, born here, and he walks into an airport, and they say, "We're going to search you." And he's like, "Well, the Fourth Amendment of the Constitution says you can't search me unless you have reasonable cause to believe, probable cause to believe, based on a reasonable interpretation of the evidence, that I have committed a crime or I'm about to." And they said, "Governor, get in that X-ray machine. We're going to put you through the shirt off porno scanner." And he said, "No." And he took it to a federal court, and he said, "This is a constitutional issue. This is my Fourth Amendment rights." And the court said, the federal court said, "We're not going to rule on this because it's a constitutional issue." And he's like, "Wait a minute, that's what you're supposed to do." And so he's got his little protest going on this. Les Rayburn is with us, conservative commentator, describes himself occasionally as a political realist or a staunch conservative. Les, welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me. What a great day.
Great to have you with us. Les Rayburn, L-E-S Rayburn, R-A-Y-B-U-R-N.com is your website. You served 35 years in the Army, two years in Vietnam, two tours to Iraq, decorated combat veteran. You know what I'm talking about in these circumstances. And I find this bizarre. We're both old enough to remember a day when you could walk up to an airport, buy a ticket, and walk on an airplane. And you still can with Amtrak and buses and things. And it seems to me like we all went a little nuts after 9/11.
We went insane.
Yeah.
We went past nuts.
Yeah.
This is insanity. And you know what? I'm not a big Jesse Ventura fan, but he's 100% correct. We walk into an airport now, and when you walk in the airport door, you take the Constitution and you put it in the shredder.
Right. You are assumed to be guilty, and you have to demonstrate your innocence. And then it even gets, and I'm no fan of, you know, who's the TV star the other day who got thrown off the American Airlines flight for turning his his phone on, Alec Baldwin. And he said that the reason, you know, he wrote this mea culpa thing over at the Huffington Post, apologizing to the passengers and saying that other people had their phones on, and he got singled out by a flight attendant who was playing Nurse Cratchit, basically. And that the reason he did it was because the plane had sat at the gate for 15 minutes without moving. So he figured, what the hell, we're still at the gate. And that all that may or may not be true. But the fact of the matter is, if you travel a fair amount, what you've noticed is that in the last 10 years, travel has gone from being, hey, we're here to help you, let's all work together, let's have a good time, to you will do that, sir. And now there are still a lot of very good flight attendants, but there's this creeping authoritarianism in our culture, not just at TSA and not just on the airplanes and not just among the police, whether they're going after Occupy protesters or whether they're just, you know, showing. I mean, we're doing SWAT raids to the tune of a couple a day right now in the United States, and with incredible number of hits that are unnecessary. I mean, to serve warrants, they're bringing in SWAT teams.
You're right. I mean, you know, the Marine that got killed the other day, where in Arizona,
yeah,
where it's the way they serve warrants is, I mean, the everyday warrant, they do it with forced entry. They don't even knock on the door and say, sir, you know, they don't even serve warrants anymore where they knock on the door. Every warrant that this one sheriff department serves, they do it with a battering ram and a SWAT team. That's how they serve every warrant. And the sheriff says, well, I don't want any of my deputies hurt. Well, why don't you do it when the guy gets out of his truck, get home from work?
Well, for that matter, you know, frankly, I mean, we had a situation 5-6 months ago where a guy shot an officer who battered in his door because he assumed it was a bad guy.
You batter in my door and you are a dead man, period. I don't care. You know what? After I kill you, I'm going to walk over and go, gee, my ninny, you know, this guy's got a badge.
Yeah, and at that point, you'll spend the rest of your life in jail. And that's and it shouldn't be that way. And this is the weird direction that America has gone. And you, as a conservative, and me, as a liberal or progressive or both or whatever you want to call me. Call me a socialist if you want. That's fine. I think that as loyal Americans, as people who believe in the ideals of this country, as people who believe in a constitution that limits the powers of government, it is as Barack Obama said and was criticized for, it is a bill of negative rights. In other words, it is restraints on the government, that things have just gone too far when you've got an 84-year-old woman being strip-searched by the TSA.
This is absolute insanity. You know, I spent 35 years in the Army, 2 years in Vietnam, a couple of tours in Iraq, and you know, if nothing else, I should be able to go down to the airport and fill out a form and submit it to somebody and get a trusted agent a ticket.
Yeah.
You know, and say, listen, you know, I carried a top secret security clearance.
But see, even that suggests that as an American, you have to lose your anonymity to demonstrate your
loyalty.
Or the lack of criminality.
Well,
I mean,
the reason why the founders
were so big on the Fourth Amendment and on people having anonymous rights is because if Rusticus, we still don't know who that guy was who put those posters up in 1773 calling people to the Boston Tea Party, and in 1775 calling people after the Boston Massacre, in 1776 calling people to the American Revolution. We still don't know who a lot of those people were, because they were able to behave anonymously, and therefore they were able to challenge governmental power. And when you lose anonymity, as you do in many of these dictatorships around the world, when you lose that anonymity or any opportunity of it, then your ability to challenge power is significantly diminished.
Absolutely agree. But, you know, we've got this 800-pound gorilla that nobody wants to talk about, and it's called our hiring practices. We, you know, if we hired differently, if we hired better qualified people for our airports, we wouldn't have to do what we do. We could and I hate to use the word profile, and it's not, I'm not talking racial profile in any way, shape, or form. I'm talking about psychological profile.
No, I think we both agree that the way that the Israelis do it is probably rational if that's what you're going to do.
Absolutely.
But, and these Chertoff X-ray porno scanners were simply a way for Michael Chertoff to
get rich.
Yeah, basically he made, you know, 10, 20 million bucks off these things, and they don't work.
And
they're illegal in Europe now because of the radiation.
My son-in-law went through the airport with a pair of flip-flops. Flip-flops. Shower shoes.
Yeah.
They made him take him off.
Yeah.
Or made him take them off.
Right.
Flip-flops.
Yeah.
Now, explain to me how you're going to hide explosives in a pair of flip-flops.
Well, I went through an airport in Germany a couple of months ago, and I said, you want me to take my shoes off? Because when I got up to the line, you know? And the woman laughed at me and said, no, we're not as afraid as you Americans are.
I am not afraid when I get on an airplane in Germany.
No, I'm not afraid when I get on an airplane anywhere, because I think the passengers will take down the next guy who jumps up with a box cutter. Les Rayburn, lesrayburn.com. Thanks for being with us, Les.
Thank you, sir.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be back. Should we? You know, I think that the whole thing is a joke, right? I mean, they're not even testing the stuff that's going in the cargo compartments.
I'll show you just how cool scientists are. We study everything, that's why we're cool. And yes, most of us got high marks in school.
Geek.
And proud. Paleoanthropology.
Welcome back, Tom Hartman here with you. Our geeky science alert for our 3 minutes during the week when I can dig into this, my passion, science. One of my passions, science. This is the HuffPost weird news from David Moy, and I don't think this is weird news. This is science news. Some people say God is everywhere, but that doesn't explain why some people see images of Jesus in toast, pizza, or even on the side of a cliff. But science does explain that. This was research done at Northwestern University, led by a guy by the name of Joel Voss. And he points out that our brains are really wired to quickly look at things and create meaning. This is a survival skill, right? What is that? Is that a tree, or is it a limb about to fall on my head? Is that a cloud in the sky, or is it a rock coming at me? So we automatically organize them according to type. That's why if you look at a baseball cap or if you look at a fancy fedora, immediately your brain thinks hat. So what they did is they took 10 volunteers and had them look at squiggles while lying under a brain scanner and rate the level of meaninglessness to the squiggle. This is sort of a variation of the Rorschach test. And what they found is that when the volunteers saw the images for the second time, their brains had already gone through the process of recognizing something in those squiggles that seemed familiar and organizing it. In other words, their brains immediately went to that spot where, oh, that's a face, or oh, that was an animal, or that was a, you know, whatever that was meaningful for them. And they didn't have to reanalyze the figures. So, you know, how is it that a 10-year-old grilled cheese sandwich featuring Jesus could sell for $28,000 on eBay? Well, because, you know, we recognize things, and for a lot of people that, and it seems like it's the people who spend a lot of time in front of images of Jesus who are saying, oh, that's what that is, because it's recognizable. So anyhow, he's in the weird news. David Moy is suggesting two products, a Jesus toaster, which imprints the image of the Almighty on bread, and a New York man is attempting to raise funds via Kickstart for a sandwich press called the Grilled Cheezus that allows believers to turn piety into paninis. Paninis with Jesus' face on them. Right. Okay. This is, you know, usually I get all kinds of these wacky emails that go around. I'm sure you do, too. Most of them are the right-wing ones, you know, this member of Congress is going to retire with zillions of, you know, and they're lies. Or they take a little bit of truth and they completely distort it. You know, they take basically that person's pension or Social Security and assume that he's going to live to 100 or what. In any case, I thought this was kind of cool. We need, and in fact, this David sent this to me. He says, you might want to think about these two guys carefully. Harry Truman dropped the bomb on the Japanese, ended the war, advocated, called for socialized medicine. Harry Truman actually, in 1947, introduced the first national single-payer health insurance system. A lot of people think that Barack Obama flirted with being the first president to introduce a national single-payer health care system and then flinched. And not only did he not suggest a national single-payer system, but we didn't even get a public option. And you can debate whether it was, you know, the Republicans or the Democrats weren't with him. You know, was it Ben Nelson, Blanche Lincoln, you know, who, what, how, why. But Harry Truman actually proposed it. And when Medicare came into effect in the 60s, the first Medicare card, 0000001 member, was Harry Truman. Harry and his wife, Bess, numbers 1 and 2. They became the first people to get Medicare. And he and Ike, with his hanging from the cross of iron speech, which I do want to get to. But anyhow, this email that's going around says, you'll never see this again. Thought you'd want to see this. You want to read it to your children and grandchildren. And I checked this with Snopes, or actually Louise checked it with Snopes, and it says, yeah, it's true. Harry Truman was a different kind of president. He probably made as many or more important decisions regarding a nation's history as any of the others. The only asset he had when he died was the house he lived in, which was in Independence, Missouri. Now, compare this with George W. Bush being a multimillionaire. Well, George W. Bush was born with millions, but, you know, tried to make more. In fact, when he was still president, they asked, you know, what are you looking forward to when you retire? And he said, you know, making money for giving speeches. Right. Bill Clinton left office broke. He's worth $100 million now. Harry Truman died, when he died, the only thing he owned was a house that he had inherited from his mother and father. When he retired from his office in 1952, his income was a U.S. Army pension of $13,500 a year. Congress, noting that he was paying for his own stamps and personally licked them, you know, responding to people's emails and things, people's letters, granted him an allowance and later a retroactive pension of $25,000 a year. First president to get a pension. After President Eisenhower was inaugurated, Harry and Bess drove home to Missouri by themselves from Washington, D.C., from Eisenhower's inauguration. Eisenhower followed Harry Truman. There was no Secret Service following them. When offered corporate positions at large salaries, Harry Truman, former president of the United States, declined, stating, you don't want me, you want the office of the president, and that doesn't belong to me, it belongs to the American people, and it's not for sale. You know, the guy who's followed in his footsteps, the only one who's followed in his footsteps since then, I think, is Jimmy Carter, who also has not gotten rich on being an ex-president. Everybody else has. Even later, on May 6, 1971, when Congress was preparing to award him the Medal of Honor on his 87th birthday, he refused, writing, I don't consider that I've done anything which should be the reason for any award, congressional or otherwise. As president, he paid for all his own travel expenses and food. He said, my choices in life were either to be a piano player in a whorehouse or a politician. And to tell you the truth, there's hardly any difference. We'll leave it at that. 27 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
He apparently could play a mean piano. I've got to share Dwight Eisenhower's speech with you, and we'll be right back with some of the other things of the actual day-to-day. Right after this. Tom Hartman here with you, your media support group for We the People of the United States of America. Welcome back, Lynn in Fairfield, Ohio. Hey, Lynn, what's on your mind today?
I was just calling about the TSA.
Mm-hmm.
My son was born without a leg, so he's had a prosthetic leg all of his life.
Mm-hmm.
The last time we flew, which was a year and a half ago, he was 13. They made him take off his shoe, which putting it back on is really hard on a prosthesis.
Mm-hmm.
Wanded him. Put him through the
Hello? Lynn? We have lost Lynn. Lynn, I'm sorry. You might want to try and call back. Hopefully our internet is holding up here. Jeff in Providence, Rhode Island. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hi, Tom. I really enjoyed your last guest and Jesse Ventura, which you had on yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the topics that they talked about, police actions, the surveillance of you know, protesters and Occupy Washington and Occupy Portland and so forth, the police actions there. You've also mentioned the you know, use of drones possibly over American cities. That whole area of discussion was actually, and the actions of the police was actually predicted back in the 90s, the late 90s. I recall listening to, you know, Bo Greitz, Alex Jones, Jack Blood.
It was
Tom
predicted
Valentine.
I think it was the late 1950s when George Orwell wrote 1984, wasn't it?
Right, but I'm saying more specific to the actions that are taking place today. These commentators that were on more or less on shortwave and alternative AM, just before the Internet took off. The Internet really didn't take off until, I guess, the...
We just lost another caller. I think maybe Jacob...
But they predicted what's going on today, not because they were psychic, but
okay,
I think they looked at trends in the government and the police, the federalization of crime, the militarization of police, and they said... This is coming, people. And these predictions, these observations, were coming from, ironically, from the right, and the libertarian, or the fringe libertarians. And the left was more reactive, and I think the right was more predictive when it comes to what you and Jesse Ventura and...
I think historically what you've found is that when people have been suffering the pangs and arrows of the police state, shall we use that phrase, without hyperbole, when they've been doing that on behalf of social justice, when they've been doing that on behalf of ending wars, ending the war in Vietnam, or the, you know, the rights of people to vote, or civil rights, or women's rights, that typically, you know, Nixon's silent majority just sat back and said, oh yeah, you know, we're not with them, you know. Let the police after them. You know, in fact, just a few days before Kent State, or maybe a few weeks before Kent State, Ronald Reagan made comments to the effect of you know, these kids need a good drubbing. And on the other hand, but now that this, you know, this thing with the TSA and the airports it's totally apolitical. It doesn't matter whether you're left or right, you know, upside down, politically, people are getting it that our government is in our face in a way that is inconsistent with our Constitution. And in the opinion of, you know, people on all sides of this thing, and when you see SWAT teams serving warrants, as my last guest was pointing out, and we're seeing increasingly, and when you're seeing the hyper-militarization of police departments, because there's a whole very, very profitable industry that's pushing this, that is, you know, got its hooks into Congress. When you look at all those things, you say, wait a minute, this is not the road that this country wants to go down, whether you're on the left or the right. And I think that there's a growing awareness of that. And I think it's really tragic when you see, you know, people like Rush Limbaugh is, you know, making $400 million. And calling Occupy Wall Street protesters hippies, you know, and making jokes about them, or, you know, Sean Hannity making jokes about people having to use the bathroom in the police bus because they've been held so long, as Sanchez was talking about earlier. I mean, this is just it's way beyond where we should be in America. You know, the police should be part of our community. We have armies to kill people and break things. We have police departments to be part of the community and serve and protect. And increasingly, our police departments are starting to resemble our militaries. And when countries go down those roads, that's a very scary and dangerous thing. And I'm just, you know, I'm not enthusiastic about it. John in Santa Cruz. Hey, John, what's up?
Hi, hey Tom, how you doing?
Good.
I'm calling because, well, there's something going on with the Republicans that really irritates me.
You too, huh?
During the founding of our country, you know, a lot of people know a lot about the Declaration of Independence and its pursuit of liberty and happiness. These are kind of the self-centered values of the Constitution. In other words, you can be an individual and reap the rewards.
Mm-hmm.
But to be a good citizen, it also talks about, okay, in other words, we can't call something un-American in America unless it's been voted on. Because in America, you need the consent of the governed to decide whether something's American or not. Because it says, powers in such form as to them shall seem most likely.
Right. The consent of the governed is a phrase out of the Declaration, not the Constitution.
Right. That's what I said.
But, you know, I'm with you. What's the point that you're trying to make, John?
The point is, you can't, okay, TSA scanning, an American, not voted on.
Yeah.
Okay?
Yeah. Here's the scary thing, though. If it was voted on, it probably would have passed.
Well, if we want to vote on socialist aspects to our government.
That's not socialism.
Well, no. Well, what I'm saying is, if Americans feel like voting on socialist aspects to the government and those aspects pass, then those are American values. American values are those values which have been voted on and passed.
Oh, by the majority of the people.
That's right.
Well,
and
you know,
anything else is un-American. And,
yeah.
And Republicans want to talk about what's un-American before it even gets to the vote.
Yeah. And mostly they want to influence the vote before it even gets to anything else. But, okay, I got your point. I got your point, John. Thank you very much. Mark Taylor Canfield in Seattle with Occupy Seattle. You just won a class action, Mark?
Hey, Tom. It's good to talk to you again.
Thank you.
Folks can follow the story actually on my blog at Daily Coast. But, yes, I did win the first leg at least of a class action civil rights lawsuit. And that had to do with people, including myself, being banned from the state capitol after not having been arrested or even charged or brought before a judge, but just given an order by the Washington State Patrol. So
right.
A judge, a U.S. District Court judge earlier this week ruled that that is unconstitutional. And so there's a temporary restraining order stopping that. So now I can go back to the state capitol and report on the events there and participate, which is, I think, a great victory for the First Amendment. But, you know, I wanted to address this issue you were talking about with police, because here in Seattle there was a story that just sort of, there was sort of like a media blackout on it, and I'm really upset about that. And that has to do with a SWAT team raid on an Occupy Seattle warehouse, mm-hmm. where a group of nonviolent activists had gone in, and they had a band playing, and they were just enjoying themselves, and suddenly the building was raided by, you know, a heavily armed SWAT team. And I know that the SWAT teams were formed to deal with very violent situations like bank robberies and hostage situations,
sure.
not to go in and evict 16 peaceful demonstrators. It's totally ridiculous. They even commandeered a fire truck with a ladder truck so that they could use the ladder truck to get up on top of the building to do this raid.
Right.
It's just another example of excessive force. And, you know, considering that the Seattle Police Department is under investigation right now by the Justice Department for use of excessive force, that's really just incredible. And the fact that the media didn't cover it and that it's not a national story and no one seems to know about it, it's also really, really irritating. But we have a situation now where the camp that Seattle has, Occupy Seattle, has 100 tents at Seattle Central Community College. We've been given a 72-hour notice. So, unfortunately, it looks like we may be experiencing the same kind of things that some folks experienced.
So, this weekend.
D.C. in the last couple of days.
It's going to come down on the weekend.
Los Angeles.
I think one of the things that they've
Friday
learned is
noon,
that...
Friday tomorrow.
I think one of the things that they... I beg your pardon?
Tomorrow at noon.
Friday noon.
Deadline. Yes.
Oh.
High noon. The showdown.
In Seattle. Okay. Well,
yeah,
Mark,
a lot of people say that they just want to leave, you know, peacefully, but I don't know how the police are going to act. You know, they've been sort of acting unpredictably across the country, so I guess I wouldn't place my bet anywhere right now.
Yeah, I mean, if this story from Patrick Meegan, this writer for Family Guy, is any indication, I mean, he just said, okay, I'll do whatever you want. I'm not going to resist. I'll leave if you want, you know, just like, and you know, they threw him to the ground and roughed him up, and he was bleeding, and all kinds of stuff. And of course, not one bankster has yet confronted a police officer. Mark Taylor, Canfield, Seattle. Thank you, Mark, for the call and for the update. Not one bankster. Not one bankster. Not one bankster.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Up next, teen violence is larger than you know. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Bill McComb is with us. He's the Chief Executive Officer of Liz Claiborne, Inc., and today at on Radio Row New York City, put together by Talkers Magazine and the Talk Radio News Center, this whole Time to Talk Day about sexual assault and physical assault, violence against women in general. And Bill, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us. Tell us what, you know, and Liz Claiborne is, I've been there physically for a couple of these, and we're sort of doing this by remote today. Give our listeners and viewers a recap of what's up and why Liz Claiborne, Inc. is involved.
Well, we call this Time to Talk Day, and what we have going on, like we have, like you said, every year for the past several years, we have some of the most important radio talk show hosts either attending live or through remote like you and I are doing, and actually interviewing important people in the world of domestic violence prevention and domestic violence in the workplace to get the message out and significantly raise awareness, concern, and help women.
Yeah, we had Judge Susan Carbon on, in fact, in the last hour from this, and as a consequence of this, and she was talking about the state of affairs, that we have some very, very strong laws, but A, by and large, they're not always enforced, and B, well, a lot of people don't know about them, and they don't know what remedies are available to them, and C, perhaps most importantly, there are agencies and resources available to battered women, to victims of rape and other kinds of assault, and even just, you know, a physical assault, typically men against women, that people that are being underfunded, that Congress is refusing to fund. And, you know, what can and should we be doing about this, Bill?
Well, look, I mean, like a lot of issues, we believe deeply that awareness is the key, that if people out there that are listening, there are a couple different audiences for these messages. One is just to raise awareness that there is actually an employer responsibility, I would argue even an obligation, to provide their associates a safe working environment.
And sure. So at Liz Claiborne, for example, what do you do?
Well, we've got, you can walk through in any of our facilities around the world, you could walk through our buildings and you would see signage that speaks to the issue, mm-hmm. that puts language around it, mm-hmm. and that gives people an opportunity to raise their hand and ask for help. We have an employee assistance program that connects very confidentially women that are facing problems at home with people that can help.
So this goes beyond, you know, the kind of stuff that Herman Cain paid those settlements for. This is if you're being beaten up by your husband, then, for example, your boyfriend or whatever, as an employer, Liz Claiborne is there to help.
That's right. And the goal is that if something like that is going on at home and you feel unsafe, you feel that your life is threatened, or you're
being stalked or something?
Yeah, badly treated. This is it's a safe working environment. It's a place where that person cannot come and get you, and we have the support networks to provide help and to do it in an expedient and highly confidential way.
What percentage of employers in America do you think say to, and there's many of them that employ a disproportionately large number of women, you know, particularly in the retail field.
Sure.
what percentage of those employers, I'm doubting, maybe there's been a survey, maybe you know the exact number, but I'm guessing that this will just be a guess, but what percentage of those employers do you think are doing the kind of programs that Liz Claiborne is doing, where you're reaching out to your employees saying, you know, we're here, and we have these resources, and we've done the research and the homework, and it's available to you right here, right now?
1 in 10. Unfortunately, I think it's a small minority,
and that's not a guess. You said that very quickly.
It's an educated guess.
Okay.
I haven't seen survey data on it, but
right.
one of the things that we know through some of the different groups that we help fund and support that have statistics like that, they talk about the fact that there are a much higher percentage than what I just named have employee assistance programs that help with all kinds of problems, but speaking to and making and driving awareness of domestic violence as a specific issue
right.
is still in the hands of few companies.
Right. Typically, those other problems, the other 90% are talking about workplace issues as opposed to...
That's right.
You know, are you being stalked? Are you being beaten up when you go home?
That's exactly right.
Yeah. And yet this is still a problem in the United States. And it's a problem that social research tells us as economies get bad, becomes worse. And so it seems like it's even more important now in the midst of a recession, depression, whatever you want to call it, to be talking about this.
I think that's right. I think one of the things we've learned in the last few years is that when times get really tough, like they have since late 2008, some of society's worst problems do in fact get worse. But one of the myths about dating violence and domestic violence is that in fact it happens to a certain status or class of people. One of the shocking things as an employer that I see is the kinds of cases of people that need help and intervention and are having big problems at home spans the entire gamut of every kind of position, including the highest of executive ranks. And it's another reason why the employer or the work site is such an efficient and important message or place, venue to get the message out.
Yeah, this is very interesting. This is I agree with that. And isn't this also an obligation of society? I mean, shouldn't for example, our elected representatives, shouldn't our government be promoting this message?
You know, I definitely think so. I really do. I think that it is. I think it's a really ugly, ugly problem, and it obviously isn't a problem just in our culture, but we may have possibly one of the most open cultures around the world, and yet this is still such a closeted, secreted problem.
So well said. Bill, thank you so much for being with us and for doing such a great job as CEO of Liz Claiborne.
Thank you so much, Tom.
Thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
You know, the Electoral College, welcome back, by the way, to our third hour of our program. The Electoral College was put together in many ways based on the way that the Iroquois did things, which was each community would appoint a wise elder. And they would all, they were called sachems, and they would all get together at a time, you know, every year and have a meeting. Although the sachems didn't actually have the ability to make a decision. They only carried the message back to the community, where in five of the six Iroquois nations, only the women voted. But there was also this idea of in the Whig histories, the WHIG histories, Paul de Ripien de Toras was the most famous. It was the one that Thomas Jefferson was most in love with. I, after reading Jefferson's autobiography, reading his writings, I went out and bought a copy of de Ripien de Toras's History of England, published in 1760-something. I bought the same copy, not the physically same copy, but the same one that Jefferson had read. And used some of it in my book, What Would Jefferson Do? A lot of it ended up on the cutting floor when the editor got done with it, because I was so in love with it, and the editor thought it was, you know, 17th century English or 18th century English. But the idea was that before the invasion of the Roman Empire, the England was tribal prior to the year 200, 300. And in fact, Jefferson, in his letter when he donated his library, he said, you know, the most important books are Tacitus, the Roman historian who was there when Agricola, his uncle, conquered the British Isles in the year 200 something or 300 something, and de Terrasse, Paul de Rapine de Terrasse, the Whig historian. And what they used to do, what the British did when they lived tribally before they were occupied by the Romans, is they had these council. Each community would appoint a wise elder, and the wise elder would come to the Vikergemeinschaft and would determine who was going to be the leader of the country. And so at that time it seemed like a really cool idea to have an electoral college where each community would elect a wise elder, and that wise elder could vote his mind. I mean, if you're an elector in the electoral college, you don't have to vote the way that your community sent you to vote. And in fact, it's happened a couple of times, only a couple of times in American history, where electors have voted in a different way. But it's kind of outlived its usefulness. You know, you don't have to ride by horseback 3 hours to get to Washington, D.C. anymore. And we do have instantaneous communication. And so now there's this movement for a national popular vote to say, you know, the Electoral College is an anachronism, and let's just elect whoever gets the most votes, and let's let campaigns be national. And Mitch McConnell seems to be quite worried about this. Scott Keyes is with us. He is a writer, blogger over at Think Progress, the Think Progress blog. Scott, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me on, Tom.
Tell us about, I have a little audio clip of Senator McConnell, who is the Republican leader in the Senate, and his paranoia about elections in general. Let me just play this, and then I'd like to let you riff off of this. Here he is.
Now is the moment. No more games, no more gimmicks. The Constitution must be amended to keep the government in check. We've tried persuasion. We've tried negotiations. We've tried elections.
Bingo.
Nothing has worked.
Yeah, we've tried elections and nothing's worked. What's wrong with this guy, Scott?
Well, that was a comment that he made in July, saying that we need to rewrite the Constitution and add in a balanced budget amendment because, you know, and this is the Republican Senate leader's words, because in his words, elections have not worked.
Right.
This is a man who's supposed to be leading, you know, at the forefront of our democracy and saying that elections haven't worked. What really doesn't work is that voters know they don't want a balanced budget amendment. That would be so draconian.
Well, we wouldn't have been able to fight World War II if we had one.
Oh,
for example,
the Paul Ryan budget itself would be essentially unconstitutional under the balanced budget amendment that Republicans are trying to peddle.
Right.
And so, you know, people like Senator McConnell are forced into positions where they, in order to try to tout the balanced budget amendment, they end up having to say things like elections haven't worked. Mm-hmm. It's pretty out there.
Yeah. So Scott Keyes, today Mitch McConnell gave a speech at the Heritage Foundation, and apparently this topic came up. And you know what happened? Give us the report.
Right. So there was a presser at the Heritage Foundation concerning the National Popular Vote. And what the National Popular Vote Compact is a group of states have gotten together and said, you know, state lawmakers have said that the Electoral College is kind of outdated. Now it'd be really difficult to actually go through the constitutional amendment process to enact a popular vote and dismantle the Electoral College, but one thing that states are allowed to do is say, you know, we're going to bind together and we will award our electors to the candidate who wins the popular vote.
Right.
Now, the genius of this plan is it only kicks in once a majority of states with electoral votes have signed on to it. So until there are states with 270 electoral votes, it won't take effect. But after that, if we were to get enough states to sign on and there are 270 electoral votes in the plan, then the winner of the national popular vote becomes president, and we don't have a repeat of the 2000 election when Al Gore won the popular vote, but George W. Bush
by a half million votes.
Oh yeah. No, it wasn't even very close. You know, I mean, he won it by hundreds of thousands of votes, and yet because of just an idiosyncrasy in the Electoral College, George W. Bush ended up becoming
president. Well, in part, also had the Supreme Court not stopped the count in Florida, Al Gore would have won, according to the recount that the New York Times did. But that's a whole other issue.
Exactly.
So now, also something that our listeners probably need to know about and our viewers need to know about is that there has been an attempt to game the system, and that is that in some of the Republican states, what they have tried to say, states that have more Republican members of Congress, because you get one electoral vote for every member of Congress. So you get two for your two senators, and then you get one for each one of your state representatives. Mm. And that in those states where a majority of those electors or those members of Congress are Republicans, they have tried, or there have been attempts, to say that this state is going to stop being all or nothing, and kind of, this is almost the reverse of the national popular vote, and each individual congressional district's vote will be counted. So, I have it backwards. In the states that are majority Democratic, the Republicans are trying to get this done so that the state won't be entirely Democratic. There will be Republican votes in there. How is that effort going along?
Right. So this has been proposed in a couple of states, in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin in particular,
right,
where they're, you know, more blue-leaning states. They've voted Democratic in the past few presidential elections,
right,
but right now Republicans control the governor's mansion and the state legislatures in both of those.
Right.
And what they're trying to do is essentially game the system. So they know that in 2012, Barack Obama is going to have the inside edge to carry Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. So what they're going to try to do is dilute the number of electoral votes that he can win by carrying the state.
Right. So we have just 30 seconds. Are they going to succeed at this?
I don't think so. I think that cooler heads are prevailing here, and that we will be able to shut down those efforts in both states. But
okay,
you know,
and the national popular vote. How far down the road do you think that is?
I think that's still going to be a couple years off. But with people like Mitch McConnell calling it a genuine threat to our country,
you know,
the Republicans are going to rally against it. So who knows?
There you go, Scott Keyes, reporter over at ThinkProgress.org. Scott, thanks a lot for the great reporting, and for coming on our show and sharing it.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Good talking with you. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
15 minutes past the hour. Senator McConnell, a genuine threat to our country. Yes, voting. That's this morning, right next door. He said it's a genuine threat. I'm not making this up. Well, according to Frank Luntz, he's terrified to death of the Occupy movement. Should Republicans be? Craig Shirley is with us, conservative PR strategist. Shirley and Bannister is his company. He's also the author of a new book that just came out, December 1941, 31 Days That Changed America and Saved the World. And Craig, before we start fighting about politics, tell me about your book.
Oh, how are you? It's been a while.
Yeah, it has been, and it's good to have you back with us.
And likewise, Tom. The book is worked on for over 2 years, and it is a day-by-day accounting of the events that were going on in the United States between December 1st, 1941, and December 31st. Each chapter is one day in the life of America, and that's really what the book is about, the life of America.
As we entered World War II after
exactly,
Pearl Harbor.
Exactly. Well, but that's
before and after Pearl Harbor.
Well, we entered the Pacific War after Pearl Harbor. We didn't enter the European War until after December 11th, when Germany and Italy declare war on us. But
that's right.
What's interesting is that intervening 4 days, there's no outcry from the American people. There's no politicians are standing up and saying, let's go after Germany and Italy too while we're going after Japan. There's no editorials, very few columns. The only thing that drags us into the European War was Adolf Hitler declaring war and Mussolini declaring war on us.
Well, and there were voices, a lot of them. I mean, did you cover the Bund movement or anything like that? I mean, you know, back in the late 30s, there
yeah,
were,
sure.
you know,
they had rallies in Madison Square Garden. They marched in parades in New Jersey.
Yeah, very active Nazis in this country.
Yeah, there was, and I touched on that there was a lot of the writers for major newspapers were enamored with the Berlin Cafe Society and were either turning their head or ignoring.
And there's a fair amount of evidence now that even the Roosevelt administration knew about the horrors that were being visited upon the Jews in Europe by the Nazis.
In this book, December 1941, I write extensively about a report that was issued by the Manhattan Institute of Jewish Affairs, a long report.
Yeah.
That was only reported on by Time magazine, as far as I could determine.
Yeah.
And they buried it on page 67, and the headline of their story was "Wandering Jews," which I found especially cruel.
Well, and we turned away a shipful, among other
things. That's right, sure.
Yeah.
This report documented the systematic elimination of Jews from Europe, and
yeah.
how there were no more Jewish doctors in Berlin, there were no more Jewish lawyers in Berlin, and there it was, and the report sank without a sight. And
yeah.
So
one of those moments when America hesitated and probably shouldn't have. But
I prefer to take the other view, and that is that nobody could comprehend that any country could engage in such monstrous behavior on such a huge scale.
Okay. Well, you know, in other words, you'd give Roosevelt the benefit of the doubt.
As I do on the conspiracists who say he allowed Pearl Harbor to happen. I give Roosevelt the benefit of the doubt.
Well, I'm quite sure that didn't happen. I actually, that's a whole other long story. In one of my books. But anyway, should the Republican Party, you're a Republican strategist,
I'm a PR guy. Well, yeah. I'm a conservative.
Conservative PR guy. Let me rephrase this then. Should conservatives worry about Occupy Wall Street, or should conservatives be saying, you know, we're with you guys. Conservative values are.
I wrote a piece for the Daily Caller about right at the outset of Occupy, in which I expressed my personal sympathy with them and how it would be a mistake for Republican leaders to engage in a knee-jerk reaction and denounce them, because what they've hurt themselves with the message. At the outset, it was a pretty clear message, and then it became a kind of a carnival, a sideshow type thing, and then they allowed.
Well, everything does. I mean, the same thing happened with the Tea Party.
No. The Tea Party kind of was better at. I hate the phrase "staying on message," but the Tea Party was better.
Come on, you had the birthers there, and you had the.
But
this is just what happens with movements. I mean, we're Americans.
I don't think it happened with the civil rights movement. I don't think it happened with the environmental.
Actually,
movement.
It did happen with the civil rights movement. You had offshoots that were violent.
But Martin Luther King wisely denounced them.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right. So he kept the focus on the central core.
But the Tea Party never denounced the birthers, and frankly, the Occupy Wall Street movement has been in many cities has been pretty aggressive about denouncing the people who are advocating vandalism or violence.
Well, I'm delighted to hear that. But back to my answer to your question,
sure.
which is, I wrote a piece saying that what they were expressing resonated with middle America, and it resonated with me. Look, I denounced the corruption and have repeatedly of Wall Street that involved both the Bush administration and the Obama administration. TARP was an abomination. It was the theft of $750 billion. Henry Paulson stuck his hand into the back pocket of middle America and gave it to Wall Street, and nobody's ever gone to jail.
Well, and Henry Paulson, during the Bush administration, pulled that $700 billion out, but then, at the same time, the Fed was pulling $7.5 trillion out.
Right, but we agree on this.
So we need some regulation. Should we bring back Glass-Steagall?
I favor a different approach, and that is that what we need is more competition, because competition will, you know, Lewis Brand.
So you think that we should start enforcing the Sherman Antitrust Act and break up the banks?
There are a million books laws on the books. The problem is they're not being enforced. That's the problem. We don't need more laws. We need more enforcement. How about the attorney?
Well, that's not my point. I mean, in 82, Reagan stopped enforcing the Sherman Act. Let's start enforcing it again.
Reagan did not stop enforcing.
He certainly did, and that's why we had a mergers and acquisition mania in 82 and 83.
But it didn't. But
he was proud about it.
They all had to appeal before a judge. They had to get approval.
Right, but the official position of the Justice Department is we are not going to be aggressive in pursuing the. Come on, this was in the news at the time, Craig. You know this.
We have
It's still that. It's still that way to this day. Bill Clinton never seriously enforced the Sherman Act. You know, the last guy who did was Jimmy Carter breaking up AT&T.
But you're just making my point, is that we already have good laws on the books. They're not being enforced. You just said that.
Well, that's what I'm saying. So I'm asking you if you'll join me in calling for President Obama to start enforcing the Sherman Act and break up these big banks.
Well, if they are in violation of antitrust, I'm all for it. Absolutely.
Okay. Amazing. We agree on something.
Well, but I am a populist. I am anti-corruption, and I'm anti- any concentration
okay.
of power, whether
Craig,
it's corporate or government.
Craig Shirley, sbpublicaffairs.com. Craig, thanks for dropping by.
You bet, Tom.
And the new book, December 1941.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
That's very interesting. And a conservative was willing to give Franklin Roosevelt the benefit of the doubt. I'm astounded. Every day I'm astounded by something. Yeah, but it's the good, the bad, and the very, very nasicornously ugly. Nasicornously means horny around the nose. Not like Dick Morrison toes, like rhinoceroses. Anyhow, brought to you by Edison Factor, a supplement for the brain. The good! Georgia State Representative Scott Holcomb. Republicans in Georgia are following in the footsteps of Florida Governor Rick Scott in trying to force all welfare recipients to submit to and pass a drug test before they can receive any benefits. So Democratic State Representative Holcomb is turning the table on his colleagues. He introduced legislation forcing lawmakers to submit to drug tests as well. As Holcomb said, if required for the poor, we lawmakers need to do it too. Nice job. Also, alcohol is a drug. You should include that. The bad, Newt Gingrich. Just when you thought Mitt Romney best represents the 1% in the Republican race, the smoking gun got a hold of one of Newt's speaking contracts. So what does the former lobbyist for Fannie Mae demand when he's asked to give a speech somewhere? Try $60,000, first-class airfare, first-class hotel accommodations, and upscale dining. But there's a few truly strange things. Gingrich also demands one non-smoking, one-bedroom suite, preferably with two bathrooms. Why on earth does Newt need two bathrooms for himself? One can only venture a guess, but I think the guy with a $500,000 line of credit at Tiffany's and extravagant spending demands may have a tough time speaking like a populist. And the very, very ugly Gretchen Carlson. This morning, GOP TV's favorite Christmas warrior went on a tirade against Rhode Island Governor Lincoln Chafee's decision to put up a holiday tree rather than a Christmas tree. Not only was Chafee ambushed by O'Reilly's little sidekick, Jesse Waters, but he also had to endure quite a tongue-lashing by Gretchen, who said, "Back when you went to elementary school, we said the Lord's Prayer in school, and slowly but surely things have changed. Maybe Christmas won't be a federal holiday coming up if it continues down this path." Right. And maybe Santa Claus will be thrown in jail, and Rudolph will be turned into glue. Who could be the next casualty of the war on Christmas? It's unclear how long until Fox realizes America is home to all sorts of religions and not just Christianity. Sadly, Christmas is still 17 days away, meaning we'll have to continue listening to this drivel for a few more weeks, and that's very, very ugly. Absolutely amazing. We get mail, and normally we have a little bumper for this, but there's a call-in line. There's a lot of ways you can communicate with us. You can post things to our blog over at tomhartman.com. You can Twitter to us at @Tom_Hartman. You can Facebook @Tom_Hartman, and we derive from all of these. But over at TomHartman.com, we also have a caller comment line. And this, I thought, was one of the more poignant and to-the-point caller comments that we've gotten in a long time. And I'm gonna let it just stand on its own without comment. Here is a caller.
Mr. Hartman, my name is Hernandez, and the reason that I'm calling it is that I find almost hilarious all these individuals that are now, oh, my goodness, I can't get a job. Oh, look at all the brutality that's taking place against us. Guess what? Minorities have been experiencing that for the past 30 years, getting masters, getting doctorates, and not being able to get a job. Now is such a big deal because now you are finding yourself to be in the same boat that minorities have been in. I do understand what it is to be part of the 99. But I got to tell you, I don't feel sorry. I really don't. You don't have a job? Go out there in the street and sell oranges. Go out there and sell whatever you can. I thank you very much and do have a good morning. Bye-bye.
It's like white privilege collides with reality in a way. Jeff in St. Louis, Missouri. Hey, Jeff, what's up?
Hey, listen, I got a suggestion for the Occupy folks.
Okay.
They should put together a political platform as a pledge and enter any race that's coming up on the national scene because, I mean, we've got two big, you know, 3 years, we've got two big elections.
Right.
And, you know, they could use the Internet for campaigning, and it would self-perpetuate itself through the media, I think.
Well, I think it's sort of happening.
We could replace a whole lot of people who will be currently running with Occupy people, and they go in there with a pledge for the 99%. They've got pretty good...
There's a dynamic tension there between the people who are in the movement wanting to say, this is a movement, this is not a political party, and we want to stay independent of politics, and we want to stay true to the movement. And I really honor that because it's movements. You know, it's Martin Luther King never declared a political affiliation in his lifetime.
We've never seen big change outside the system. And the only way
I disagree.
Is to get inside the system with people...
I think that you've got the order reversed. The big change always comes. It's not actually change. You're right. The big pressure always comes outside the system, which causes those inside the system to react to it and produce the change. Lyndon Johnson signed the Civil Rights Act.
Let me put this: if you had the right people inside the system, you wouldn't have to pressure them to do the right thing.
No, I disagree. I think that President Obama, when he came to office,
they're true to their cause.
No, Jeff, respectfully, I disagree with you. I believe that had there been an Occupy movement starting on day one, you know, when Franklin Roosevelt came into office in 1932, the Bonus Army, just months before, had been run off the White House, the lawn of the White House, and all the way down to the Potomac, 45,000 people. Occupying Washington D.C. and President Hoover had Douglas MacArthur come in with eight tanks and a whole bunch of guys on horseback and burn down this village, this Hooverville, this encampment, the Bonus Army encampment, and you had Hoovervilles springing up all across America. They were Occupy movements. This is not something new. This happened in the 1930s. And it had been going on for 3 years when President Roosevelt was sworn into office in March of 1932. Virtually all the banks in the United States failed in the weeks before he was sworn into office, in the time between the time he was elected in November and the time he was sworn in March, which is a long period of time, which is why they shortened it with an amendment to the Constitution just a few years later. Virtually all the banks failed, and you had these Hoovervilles springing up all over the country. One of the biggest, as I believe I mentioned this earlier, one of the biggest was in Seattle, and the mayor of Seattle was a guy named Jesse Jackson, and he wrote a book about it in 1935, which I've been trying to get my hands on a copy of. I can't find it anywhere, so if you run across one or you know of one, let me know. But anyhow, this is not something new, and I think that, you know, having the movement, having the power and the pressure in the movement will move politics. Always has, always will. By the way, Virginia Tech, just a couple of quick things here. Virginia Tech, a police officer stopped somebody for what she thought, apparently, she thought was a routine traffic check and was apparently shot to death. And the shooter had apparently killed somebody else. And, you know, this story is playing out right now. And also, just a FYI, this is not a paid endorsement or anything like that. I just wanted to share this with you. Louise and I, for well over a decade, have been customers of the Organic Wine Company, organicwinecompany.com, and because, you know, wine is one of the products, agricultural products, that are most heavily sprayed with pesticides, and so we've always just said, you know, if we're going to drink wine, have a glass of wine with dinner, I want it to be organic. And Veronique Raskin, who runs that company, is doing a a case study of people who get headaches and things from regular wine, and she's got this thing going. I'll just leave it at that. You can read all about it over at organicwinecompany.com, just as an FYI. I think it's something really cool, and something might come out of it of some interest and value. Ronnie in Stuart, Virginia. Hey, Ronnie, what's up? Ronnie? No, Ronnie. Okay, Mike in New Haven, Ohio. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind?
How you doing, Tom?
Good. What's up?
Well, I just called to find out about this legislation that passed as far as America being a battleground. Now they can pick you up and just take you away, and
it hasn't passed.
No rights whatsoever.
It hasn't passed. What?
It's not as of yet, but from what I'm to understand, I watch C-SPAN. You know, since Bush and his regime took over and ran us into the ground, I've been in politics like you wouldn't believe. I am a veteran, and I did take an oath to swear and protect the Constitution of the United States.
Yes.
Now, all veterans will do that, and they will defend and give their lives. We're not like politicians where we just give our mouths. And I'll tell you,
politicians take a similar oath.
Yes. Okay. Look at what
they should, and they should
we
do
had
it.
The Patriot Act that got shoved up.
I know. We had a period of time where we went nationally insane, and there were a few of us standing on the side who were saying, "Wait a minute, this is insane." The Patriot Act, and keep in mind, the Patriot Act came about after the anthrax attacks, which only hit the two senators who could have stopped the Patriot Act, Pat Leahy, the head of the Senate Judiciary Committee through which it had to pass, and Tom Daschle, the head of the Senate Majority Leader, who had to bring it to the floor. And those were the only two senators who got anthrax. And just before the Patriot Act, and just after they had said, you know, we're not so sure about the Patriot Act. And you can make of that what you want. But I think that we went nationally insane because we had insane people in the White House at the time. And we do need to stop that.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Absolutely with you. We need to stop that insanity. So the question then becomes, how? And I'd start by saying, I'm not afraid.
From the war against disorder, from the sirens night and day, from the fires of the homeless, from the ashes of the gay, democracy is coming.
Well, one can hope. I think it is. We do have, beyond our political problems, however, in the United States, there are a variety of challenges that we are facing as a nation. And the right now in New York City, talk radio news and the Talkers magazine and a group of people have put together this Radio Row, It's Time to Talk Day. Sponsored in part by one of our previous guests, actually, Liz Claiborne. Thank you very much. There you go. And Sharon Staple is with us. She is the executive director of the New York City Anti-Violence Project, AVP, and an attorney. AVP.org is the website for the New York City's Anti-Violence Project. Sharon, I assume I'm pronouncing your last name right?
You are. Thank
okay,
you.
Thank you. Thank you for joining us. How do we raise awareness of domestic violence, and particularly encourage reporting in the LGBTQ community?
Well, I think this is one of those ways to do it, is to have a kind of day like Liz Claiborne is sponsoring today, It's Time to Talk. I think we have to be talking about the issue. We have to recognize, first of all, that there's a problem, recognize that there are resources that are available to solve the problem, and then recognize that we need a broader strategy nationally to be able to end violence against everyone, but including lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer folks who are often left out of this conversation.
Yeah, although I thought sometimes that Q meant questioning as well. But in either case, the HIV-affected communities, one of the things that we see so often is basically, you know, trashing just the concept of bullying, like it's some kind of liberal conspiracy or whatever. And many of the, you know, the teenage suicide rate, for example, in the United States is highest in the gay community.
Mm-hmm.
And How do you push through the fact that this is being politicized when this is really a social and cultural issue that shouldn't be about politics?
Well, I think it's also a political issue. I think it's a social, cultural, and political issue. I think when you are talking about bullying, what you're really talking about is a history of discrimination against a group of people because of their identity, right? Mm-hmm. We're talking about homophobia, we're talking about transphobia, and that's a culture that we live in this country, and that's a political issue. It's a social and cultural issue as well. And I think that's the context in which, when we're talking about bullying, we're usually talking about violence that people experience in schools, in universities, or on the street, walking down the street, in their job, right, in their neighborhoods. That's the context in which a lot of LGBTQ people experience their lives in this country. And then when you add to that this concept that they could also be in violent or controlling relationships, I think you're looking at a group of folks who have not had access to the traditional support systems that are available to many survivors of lots of kinds of violence. And you're working with an entire community where, while we're focusing on bullying and that's incredibly important, what we're not talking about is intimate partner violence and how that's happening in relationships. So there's a lot of isolation. There's a lot of lack of information there too.
We had this conversation with the CEO of Liz Claiborne, and he was talking about how, you know, they're trying to educate all of their employees to the fact that if your husband or wife is physically or sexually or in any other way, being violent, abusive towards you, there are remedies, and the company actually will make some, will help you find those remedies.
Mm-hmm.
For many people in our society who are gay, that's like another level of impediment. And they may not know about those resources, and in some cases they may be afraid to use those resources for fear that they will come up against a wall of discrimination.
Exactly. And that's where I think you see the intersection of discrimination and the intimate partner violence issues. And I think part of what we need is a commitment to everyone who's looking at the issue of domestic or intimate partner violence and thinking this is something that is wrong and that we can remedy, and that together we have to talk about and make a public health issue and not just an issue between a couple or two people.
Right.
I think every single person who has that commitment also has to have a commitment to including every person who's surviving domestic violence. And that means being able to talk about sexual orientation and gender identity. It means being able to talk about a lot of things, immigration status, race, socioeconomic status, all of those things. But certainly we have to be comfortable with people's identities before we think that we are providing a safe space for them to come forward and ask for help or support.
Traditionally, I don't mean that in the positive sense. Historically, probably, mm-hmm. I should say. Instead, people in the African-American community or other minority communities, Native American communities, have been wary, at the very least, of bringing their problems, even problems that involve crimes, particularly these kinds of crimes against persons by relatives, to the police,
mm-hmm.
because the police are hostile to them to begin with, or they perceive that hostility. Is it not a legitimate concern that a lot of gay people think that if they walked into a police station and said, I'm a man and my boyfriend is beating me up, that the police officer, there's this macho culture within our police, that they may be met with something other than, okay, let me help you?
Absolutely. I mean, we at the New York City Anti-Violence Project, we run a national coalition of anti-violence programs, so we put out a report every year. And this year's report showed that 93% of the people who called our offices to report violence did not call the police department, which is a typical remedy that many people, particularly in non-transgender heterosexual relationships, many people think, oh, the first thing I do is call the police. The second thing I do is think about domestic violence shelters or a domestic violence hotline. That's not a resource that LGBTQ people see as available to them. And part of that, I think, is that sort of historic discrimination and lack of understanding about sexual orientation and gender identity and the bias that comes along with that. And part of that is that it is a very real thing that the police have often, in many parts of this country, been a part of the violence and the problem itself.
And we need to wake up to that. And you are doing great work with that over avp.org.
Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sharon, so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
It's an honor. Coming up tomorrow on our program, it's Friday. That means it'll be Brunch with Bernie, America's Senator, taking your calls for a full hour, our national town hall meeting. And don't forget, democracy starts when you get involved, when you show up, tag, you're it, occupy something. We'll see you tomorrow here on Occupy the Airwaves.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.